and sing along. Yeah. Rap is so boring, now correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. It's like they took the art form. I'm tired of the same rap songs.
Good afternoon, this is Sean P.
Big Root.
And we're the brothers. And
from the Bronx.
Live from the Bronx, and we have a special guest. We're just going to jump right into it today. Today's episode is titled Enforcing the Law. And we are very blessed and happy to have a longtime friend way before the podcast even was a thought. This is one of the true Brew Brothers that's just always been there. And he has a wealth of experience to share with us today. So, Big Roop, you want to introduce our special guest?
Yes, without further ado, we have Big Brother H in the house.
Greetings and salutation, my brothers.
Likewise. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So listen, just to really jump into it, because we know that the last couple episodes, we've jumped around some topics, but it always kind of comes back to the same overall situation. And the reason we wanted to hit up today's topic of enforcing the law is because we have an epidemic aside from the COVID virus. And the epidemic is law enforcement's interaction with people of color that far too often ends in deadly and negative circumstances. And it seems that there's not enough expression from members of law enforcement who are also people of color. Right. Because the thing is, you know, it shouldn't be a dividing line. Right. There's no reason that the color line is a dividing line when it comes to us in society and law enforcement. It shouldn't be people on color on one side and people on law enforcement on the other. So just jumping right in, Big Brother H, do you feel that that line is real?
Oh, it absolutely is. It absolutely is. I saw a video clip earlier today about a police chief in Minnesota. Black man. And one of the things that he said was even he, after having a negative experience with the police, feels uncomfortable whenever a police patrol car pulls up behind him or whatever the case is. And I've felt it too. I've had my own issues when I was active in law enforcement. And, you know, I've had good and I've had bad. It's out there.
Well, the funny thing is, what is it? And is it something that came up or is it something that's always been there? Because I think that's the thing. There are some of us who almost feel that maybe it wasn't always a reality. And the last maybe 10, 15 years, it's skyrocketed. But then we can just go back through the 70s and the 60s and the 50s and just understanding that between the institutional racism and literally just law enforcement's interaction with people of color, it's always been there. So what is the it? Like, what is really going on from your perspective?
Well, I think that is just it. Institutional racism, it's always been there. When I came on the job in 2006, I noticed the spectrum. You had a very few and select white officers on Rikers Island that had the best posts, were the chiefs and the wardens and over a very short period of time, you started to see that change, but it never really completely changed. Rikers Island is comprised of mostly Black and Hispanic officers, very few actual white officers. Mm. You know, in the jail that I came from, just a handful out of maybe 700 or 800 officers in total were white.
Mm.
And let's keep it in a better perspective. There is racism to a certain degree or prejudice between law enforcement agencies. Mm. There are some agencies that treat other agencies in a horrible way. And I'll give you an example. This is something that I've not heard of from one or two officers, one of my friends, where officers on Rikers Island, correction officers, are viewed as criminals with a shield. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they view us as such is because we spent an enormous amount of time in the jails, locked in, providing care, custody, and control with detainees and inmates. And I'm not going to candy coat anything. Whenever you're immersed in an environment, sometimes 17 hours a day, sometimes 4 out of the 4 days on your rotation, you learn to communicate a certain way. You learn to interact a certain way because it is the environment that you're in, and that's jail. Problem is, some officers don't know how to turn that off. They don't know how to turn it off. So they bring it home with them and everything else. But that is where that prejudice comes from. So when we talk about what is the problem, was it there in the 60s and the 70s? Hell yeah, it was there. One of the reasons why the city made the law that officers had to live in the city is because there were so many white officers at one time that was coming into the city to work as police officers who did not have any kind of understanding as to what that environment entailed. They came from the suburbs. They didn't know how to interact. And so that was the city's effort to try and address that issue without coming out to the public and saying, you know, this is a problem.
Right. Gotcha. Big Rube, you have any perspective on that particular topic? Because like you said, I mean, I don't think I've ever heard that before as far as departmental racism and institutional prejudice. Because like you said, I mean, it's very insidious. So, I mean, what's your take on that, Big Rube, or just in general?
Well, I think from the outside, we wouldn't. We view law enforcement as like one entity, whereas in their segment, they have different levels of law enforcement. So I can see that happening. You know, as an outsider, we're just going to see them as all as law enforcement, but they have different levels of what's going on. And what Howard said, I mean, what he said earlier about there being, this has always been there. I agree. I think that it's just being more recorded now than it is before. So we're getting to see these encounters a lot more than we did before. Okay. So I think that's also plays into our perception.
Okay. But let's just take the last 10 years, for example. Let's just condense and start to condense it, because the three of us have basically lived here our whole lives. And from my own perspective, I've had interactions with the police, just general interactions. I mean, I won't even say anything suspicious or whatever. Just literally, you live in certain areas and police patrol certain areas and you're going to interact. And I, for the most part, have never had any subliminal fear of the interaction, as long as I wasn't doing the wrong thing, right? So the times cops engaged me, I literally spoke up with all of my rights and authority. Never in an aggressive manner, never in a confrontational manner, but literally in the manner that I'm a citizen, you're in law enforcement, and as long as I'm not doing the wrong thing, as long as I'm not a criminal, right, I have nothing to fear. I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to toss. So I can communicate with you. I would say the last couple of years, even me as an adult now, I don't have the same feeling. I feel that the relationship has changed enough where it doesn't really matter if you're a criminal. As you mentioned, Big Brother H, even with the police chief, right? We're talking about a police chief, someone at the top of a law enforcement department has the same feeling that I'm nervous. And what is that? I don't know if that's always been there, where police chiefs feel nervous about the very world they live in.
Well, maybe not. I will say on my end of the spectrum, for example, I've always had tinted windows since I've had vehicles. So let's say we're going back 30 years. And I can recall being pulled over on those occasions. And I can recall dealing with two types of officers. The one that pulls you over, sees you, talks to you, realizes that you're not a threat and says, hey, you need to take that off or you need to deal with it or beat it. Right. And then you have the other ones, which I actually had an interesting experience. It was right after, I don't know if you recall, some auxiliary officers, I think one or two of them got shot and killed.
I remember that.
In Manhattan. And interestingly enough, and I'm going to say it on the podcast, right? The lead suspect in that situation, once he was captured, he was brought to my jail.
Mm.
And I can tell you with great uncertainty that the minute he was brought into that facility, it was at a point in time when officers were able to take out their frustrations, because we as correction officers felt that it was a violation against law enforcement, period. And so we dealt with it as such. So I'm hoping you read across, behind the lines. Now, just a short while afterwards on Fordham Road, I was driving home with my girl. I got pulled over because of the tint on my window. A male Caucasian officer comes, pulls me over, gets out of the car, approaches the car, makes sure that as he approaches the car, he's out of my field of view, and explains to me that he's pulling me over because of the tint of my car, and asks me if I have a medical condition that requires me to have such tint. I explained to him that I'm a law enforcement officer. I work on Rikers Island. The building that I intake detainees to comes from the very same borough that I live in. I use the tint to maintain my anonymity. And his exact words to me was, be careful. There are a lot of trigger-happy officers after what just happened.
Wow.
Now, that was a direct threat to me. Now, I'm a black man. I got a gun on me. I got my girl in the car. Wow. And I turned to him and I said, what? I said, do you realize when this guy came into the jail, do you know what we did? this guy, let me tell you, he made sure, and I started to ask for his shield and his name. He made sure that he shrunk away out of my field of view. And I didn't get out the car, because I knew if I had gotten out the car, that would have been a direct act of aggression, and he would have had some bounds, whether he felt, whether it was actual or not, to now reciprocate on a high level. So I say all of that to say that these are the types of interactions that people have. I think people are... I'm not saying everybody is bad in the projects and every black person is a drug dealer or whatever, but the few that are make it bad for everyone else in terms of perception. And so a police officer who's from the suburbs, who has this image of the aggressive black male, who's probably up to no good because that's what the stats say, is going to react to us a certain way. Doesn't even matter if we're law enforcement or not. They're going to treat us a certain way. And then when they find out, 9 times out of 10, unlike with this guy, and I don't even call him an officer, with this guy, you get an apology or, I'm sorry, or whatever the case is. But 9 times out of 10, a lot of times you don't get that either. Mm. So that's just an experience that I had. Now, I'm still not saying all officers, all Caucasian officers are bad. But if I had that mindset where that's the police, that's what they do, that's how they act, that's how they treat black people, then it wouldn't be right. But that's the mentality that a lot of people have. They had an interaction where it wasn't good, and so now all police are bad. Just like police are saying, all black people are bad because I had to arrest this perp yesterday for selling drugs or doing whatever.
Gotcha. Big Room could jump in, because we did do an episode on stereotypes at one point, right? And we really tried to kind of cover from all angles, because we all have stereotypes. We all live in a world where we prejudge people before we truly engage them, because that's just part of the human experience, right? But the thing is, some of the stereotypes are not only inaccurate, they're dangerous, right? And I think one of the stereotypes from the general public's view is that all law enforcement are heroes, right? And I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean that, no, they are our fellow citizens doing a very dangerous job. And I think they're given a lot of power and a lot of support, the badge and the gun, because of that job. But like you said, the stereotypes go in different ways. You're also, you know, you were one of those individuals given a great deal of power and a great deal of respect. But what happens is because you're also a person of color, a black man, you are also viewed through another stereotype. And what happens is our society is letting the stereotypes persist as opposed to the genuine people. So like you said, a lot of us are basically guilty, even if not proven innocent. Right. Even if proven innocent. And I mean, if Big Rue wants to jump in on that, because that was a very important thing when we say, well, we see the cops one way. Right. We're like, no, but it's us one way. And they're dealing with us based on they see us. We walk out of an apartment and they're not looking at you or I or anybody going to work. They're seeing, like you just said, Big Brother H, the dude on the corner who is hustling. And we're all getting lumped into that regardless of what we do. So Big Rue, I don't know if you want to add to that, if you remember that episode.
No, I remember the episode and you talked in a lot of good points there. Where it is the perceived stereotype that people react to than the person. So again, law enforcement sees African-American males a certain way. Caucasians might see police officers a certain way, whereas young African-Americans might see the cops a certain way. If someone was getting harassed, you're not the good guy. You're the harasser. You're the overseer that's harassing me every day. So everybody has their stereotypes and no one's gone by the actual person.
But when these situations happen, are we reacting to the stereotype? Like, in other words, there's no need to even revisit the Chauvin trial because I think that was, like, very clear and explicit. But the reality is there's going to be a follow-up trial, right, because there was three other officers that were there. And at this point, it's fair to say that they witnessed a murder because if Chauvin was convicted of murder and they were there, then they were witnesses to a murder. Yet at what point did they not observe that murder and feel the need to react to that murder? And I think that's a good talking point, right? Because we know that we're being seen one way. We know that the world of stereotypes is persisting, right? But how do we begin to break that? Like, how do we, Big Brother H, Big Room, how do we break that where we're not stereotypes, right? We're nobody's a stereotype. We start with stereotypes, but each person is who they are. If I'm going to the supermarket, that's literally all I'm doing.
I don't think that I don't want to sound cynical or anything. I don't think we break it because you have to remember the ideology of what racism is and prejudice is. The folks like you and I grew up a certain way. They were taught a certain way. I've seen the videos of classes being conducted here in the United States in the 50s and 60s, where the kids were taught that the blacks and Indians were enemies and all of these things. Now, that mentality came from their parents. They experienced that on a day-to-day basis growing up. They learned it in the schools. Their parents taught their kids the same mentality. And that is the repercussions of the kids of my generation in law enforcement who are white, coming from a suburban background. Not saying, again, all of them, but I'm saying a great many of them. I can tell you, just speaking about the Chauvin case and how that went down, that as a law enforcement officer, aside from the fact that this was a human being that was being slaughtered on camera, it went against every grain of training. Forget about the human element of this. It went against every grain of training as a law enforcement officer coming from New York City. Now, my training might be slightly different than a police officer's. But at the end of the day, we're taught to restrain if necessary and then provide care, medical care. That's a number one rule. We're taught to handcuff. And then if they're on the ground, sit them up so that they can breathe. They're never left in a reclined position. And so for those officers to have their knees in their backs and then to even hear in the trial where in some cases they were defended and said that this was part of protocol, it was horrendous, horrendous. And I said, there's no way a correction officer on Rikers Island, forget about what's happened with other police officers in New York City, there's no way that if that happened on camera on Rikers Island, that any officer, black, white, or indifferent, wouldn't have been crucified for doing something like that.
And yet it took a lot for Chauvin to be crucified. I mean that situation with George Floyd did galvanize the world, because like you said, people watched a human being slaughtered, right? And not to say that's indicative of all the most interactions, but it stood out because of what you said. It was particularly grotesque. But the reality is there was still a lot of support for Chauvin, right? From the union, from some of his fellow officers. Certainly the three officers that were there didn't have an immediate reaction to what he was doing to stop him, which is what I think a lot of people were saying, well, how do you not stop him? Get off of him and that. So is it something more insidious? We know that institutional racism is there. We know that we live in a world of stereotypes and big group. You know, you can just let jump in as far as if you have any particular point to that. But how could Chauvin have been supported? In other words, we all saw what happened. I understand he has a legal right to a defense, right? But like you said, training, law enforcement across America, different divisions of law enforcement, right? They're meant to restrain and control a situation, not to exterminate a human being. And we all saw it happen. So, Big Roo, what is your take on that? Like, how could there be any support for him?
Well, I'd like to know, what is the line you have to cross to be denounced? It seems that there's no line that they can cross that they get denounced. I know the union's going to try to find a way to defend an officer at every stretch, but fellow officers, even regular people. I mean, when the verdict was going to be read, most of us were scared that he wasn't going to get punished. We thought he was going to get off. It wasn't even like it was a clear-cut case, even though you saw it on camera, and it was like a murder that you saw straight up. You weren't sure that they were going to convict.
Exactly, Big Brother H. You said it yourself. In Rikers Island, to Big Roo's point, an officer would have been crucified for that. And like you said, even up to the point of reading of the verdict, there was this, is it really going to happen? Like, we know we saw the murder, right? But is it really going to go that way? And why? Like, why should something so clearly obvious wrong still be in a cloud of, well, maybe this was just natural law enforcement?
The system, and it goes back to that institutional prejudice and racism, right? The legal system, you hear about it all the time. Lawyer believes dead to right that his client is guilty. Lawyer does his best to lie and collude and manipulate the truth to get that person off. That's what they're paid to do. That's what the defense does. So I don't think we saw anything different when it came to the Chauvin case. I think that their defense tried to present people and quote-unquote facts that defended his actions. We're going to continue to see that. That's not going to change. But when it comes to what actually took place in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and going back 400 years of what was done to the black people, right? It still kind of puts us like the deer in the headlights. And that fear is so real because we've seen the system get off, not in this case, but we've seen situations in which police officers, or just in general, white folks compared to black folks, because if you look at the stats, you'll find that white folks do less time than black folks do for the same crimes, you know, be it heinous crimes or not. Look at all the mass shootings where you had white people get caught and not killed. Whereas when it comes to it being a black person, they shoot first and ask questions later. So it's a systemic problem that gets addressed by programs like your podcast, where hopefully people tune in and start to really understand and start to get the right politicians in that can affect change from that level, and slowly it'll go to the top. Slowly. But it's an uphill battle.
Got you. Thank you for sharing that, because I mean that was really powerful, because you know what? It really is a lot of doom and gloom, because like you said, we see it, we're living it. Because you're right, the deer in headlights is a great analogy, because I think most of us understand now that anytime we go outside our doors, we're potential targets, regardless of what we're doing, regardless of what we're not doing, right? And I think that's the scariest part. I think we were taught, many of us, not to be criminals, not to do the wrong thing, to be safe. And now we realize it doesn't really matter. As you said, the few criminals have basically projected it out towards all of us, or rather the system has used a few criminals to target all of us. And that's probably a better way of looking at it. Instead of blaming a few criminals out there, we really have to, like you just said, it's systemic. But the problem is now it doesn't matter what we're doing, what we're not doing as individuals. We just have to be careful. But we do have to work towards systemic change. I don't know what you want to add to that, Big Group. But I mean, you know, Big Brother H did point in the right direction, right? We have to use our podcast. We have to continue to send text messages and share videos and to build a community of awareness, right? Because ultimately it's going to come down to right and wrong. And I think with the Chauvin trial, that's what really came out. Even in the face of systemic racism, something that was clearly wrong, right? When it's kind of wrong, we kind of see where the system goes the way you just said it does, Big Brother H, where, you know, we're not all going to get treated the same way, right? We're supposed to, but we're not. But when it's clearly wrong, clear, and I think that's the difference. I mean, there's times our people were lynched and it was basically a celebration, right? Everybody had fried chicken and literally celebrated. So obviously there was no justice. In this case, there was a lynching, but I guess we've moved somewhat to a point where that would get justice.
I also think that they were forced into it to a certain degree, where I think that there would have been a level of civil unrest in this country if he had not been sufficiently punished, that it would have just changed the face of America again in this day and age. Because I think for everything that we went through as the people through civil rights, I think they were able to sweep a lot of that under the rug. I think a lot of that did not get to other countries the way it probably should have or could have. But now in this age, you know, like you said, the minute something goes awry, it's on camera. People are pulling out their phones. They're seeing it. And I just think that there was just a degree of like, we, you know, how can we go against serving justice to this guy or else the United States would have been on fire, literally, probably. And I think that's what a lot of people are waiting for, like that nervous pit in our stomach when we were waiting for that. There was a lot of people that was going to go out there and act a fool because of it. And then I think some people would have lost their lives on top of that, too.
I totally agree with what Brother H said. I think that they know that there was going to be some type of repercussions if they didn't come back with the proper verdict. Not saying it was indefinite, but I think that was definitely in their mind. You know, the question I have for Big Brother H is there ever going to be a situation where blue lives are going to be like, what we did was wrong and we need to change? Or is everything always going to be hold the line? No matter what is done, we have to make sure that blue lives, you know, the police department and all law enforcement is looked at in a certain way, because they never ever want to say they're wrong. Never.
Well, I think that the again, it's the system to a certain degree, right? That is the reason why the city indemnifies a police officer when he uses his firearm. Because from a litigious standpoint, at the end of the day, they don't want to get sued. It becomes dollars and cents, not right or wrong. And I don't know if that will ever change, because the other side of this whole thing is when you are in a situation, just like a soldier, where you're in a situation in which you go out into the world every day and literally your life is at risk every day. And the partner that you work with every day is responsible for covering your six every day. And you both know the overall life-threatening challenges that can develop on any given day. Your focus becomes, I'm coming home. I have to do whatever it takes to come home. There is no civilian. And the majority of law enforcement, think of it this way, the majority of police officers, they will never use their firearm in a live, on-duty situation. They may pull it, they may have to, you know, present it, but they never actually have to pull that trigger. And I think the other problem that we have is that from the civilian standpoint, they can become too critical, because what I've heard is, oh, well, if you're that scared, you shouldn't be a police officer, or that your training has presented you with a situation. We've taught you not to pull that trigger 17 times if you're in a situation. And honestly, we are. We're taught to shoot 2 to 3 times, scan, which is to see if the threat has been neutralized. And then if so, post our firearm at the scene to, you know, securing the officer. There's no situation in which officers has been trained to empty his clip indiscriminately. But none of us can speak of what happens when that adrenaline is going and you feel like you're in a life-threatening situation. None of us can speak of the 2 to 3 seconds, the average of 5 to 7 feet that the average gunfight is. That's what it is, 5 to 7 feet. So on average, so who can speak to how you react when you see somebody coming out of his pocket and it turns out to be a wallet? I'm going to be honest with you, bro. This is going to be, but so many situations, be it if this person is black, white, or yellow, then I'm going to sit there and wait for him to present a firearm and point it at me. That's why I'm not a police officer. So, you know, and I'm very careful to be very critical. You know, for a fact, you'll send me something and I'll say, okay, well, you know, in this situation, I'm not vilifying this individual for his reaction. I would have done the same thing. And we don't always agree on that. Mm-hmm. But I explained to you. So another point that I would have to make under the same context. I know from my training and every correction officer, I don't know for police, but I'm assuming it's the same way. We are taught to shoot center mass, period. We are not taught to shoot warning shots. We are not taught to shoot at an arm or a leg or a head. Matter of fact, if you're on the line and you start shooting headshots, they will remove you off the line because they feel that you have some psychological issue. That's a fact. I've seen it done. And we laugh all the time. You know, we might put one up there, but you put that second one up there, bro, you're coming off the line. And that's just it. There's no officer that's taught to hurt a perp once they use their firearm. They are taught to neutralize that threat, period.
Well, there's the thing. That is a really good point. And I just want to say we are coming up on the time. I don't know how either of you gentlemen are doing for time. Because if we need be, we could actually just pause, jump out, jump back in, or we can sum it up and do a follow-up.
I'm good. We can keep on rocking. I just want to say that this is my birthday today.
Oh, that changes the whole scenario. Happy birthday.
Thank you. I was not going to, and I want you to understand, I was not going to say, no, I can't do this because it's my birthday, because I feel it's that important to do.
Understood.
So I'm not rushing, but I know in about half an hour, 45 minutes, some folks are going to come and pick me up and take me out and have their way with me. I'm good until left.
What's going on, man? I don't understand it. I want something good to listen to. I demand it. All the real artists on another planet. And me, I'm the last MC still standing.
So, yeah, as we were just saying, both you guys just made really good points. Big Roop, you really just kind of brought home one of the biggest things I think people of color feel as far as the dividing line between law enforcement and people of color. When do blue lives hold themselves accountable, right? Part of the reason there is a Black Lives Matter is because there's a sense among people of color, of the communities at large, that blue lives are not being held accountable and they're not holding themselves accountable. And that's kind of the thing. Like, clearly that's wrong. And no, that's just normal policing. And Big Brother H, you know, you then followed up saying that, hey, you know, these guys are leaving their precinct and they're going out into the world and they want to make sure they go back to the precinct. So how do we resolve those two issues? Because we have Dante Wright, who through a series of events was killed by a taser, and it wasn't a taser, but you know my point. All the training, all the preparation, everything that, that led up to that moment, taser, 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 but it wasn't a taser. It was a gun. And he's dead, and there's nothing that's going to undo that. So where do we reconcile those two things? The fact that Blue Lives do not seem to be holding themselves accountable, and what can people do with that?
Well, if I could jump in, I will say that, and look at using that same example, where is that officer right now?
She's in jail.
Okay, so we have a situation in which there was no ifs, ands, or buts, basically. They found her behind up in jail. So here's my thing. We talk about training and everything else, but at the end of the day, it still boils down to the individual. I honestly don't think, with everything going on, I think she plain lost her mind. And I think that does supersede training, right? If you're in a if you're in a combat situation, there's no telling how I will react compared to how you would react, Rupert, or you would react, Sean. There's a difference. We could all undergo the same training and react differently when the situation is presented. I think she was uncontrollably nervous. I think that she knew she had a body cam on. I think that she knew that this footage would be seen.
Right.
And I think she was fearful of the outcome because it's recorded. Oh shit.
Right.
You know her reaction.
Right. All right. To jump in right there, a couple points you made that have to be just addressed. Right. We're living in a post George Floyd world. Right. So you're right. The tensions are out there. So do we believe that the same result would have happened as fast with her had this been prior to George Floyd? That's just number one. Because, again, that goes back to what Big Group just said. Many of us are looking for Blue Lives to hold themselves accountable, right? Because we don't know this. We don't put on the badge. We don't put on the gun. So we know you're going out into a war zone, right? But when you do the wrong thing and those around you see the wrong thing is done and you're saying, oh, nothing to see here. That's when you get people in the street saying, what do you mean nothing to see here? We all saw it. Like Big Rupert always says, we're not seeing that there's something to see here. And you're literally looking at us with the evidence in front of us telling us there's nothing to see here. So you're not holding yourselves accountable. So now Blue Lives is now being met with Black Lives because you're not holding yourselves accountable. If every time something goes wrong, for the most part, that's seen and you guys are being held accountable, you are going to jail, right? Why was there a conversation with Amber Geiger? How do you shoot somebody in the wrong apartment? What conversation is there? It doesn't matter if you're a police officer or not. You don't know where you live. You can't find your own house. It is what it is. So every time that we see these things not being met reasonably, in the closing of the child and trial, the defense attorney talked about a reasonable officer. And that might have had some weight if he didn't show the pictures of what actually happened, where everything that Derry Chauvin did was unreasonable. That wasn't reasonable. That was as unreasonable as it can be. So I think to Big Roo's point, you can speak to it better than I can. When do you hold yourselves accountable so other people don't have to step in to try to hold you accountable?
I'll let Roo.
Well, I think that basically they don't hold themselves accountable, be it Eric Garner, be it Chauvin, Philando Castillo. They never seem to think that they did anything wrong. And I think that's a problem that civilians like myself have. It's one thing if everybody's condemning it. Oh, my God, this is horrible. It's a mistake. This person went above and beyond what they should have done as an officer, and they have to be punished. But you never hear that from law enforcement. It's always the training kicked in, and this is what happened, and there's nothing to see. So that's what makes a civilian like me very upset.
Well, I will say this. I think that we are generalizing, okay? And it's a natural reaction. I'm a correction. Give you an example. Real life example. Down the street from my house is a gas station. One night I'm in the gas station. The tanker is pumping some gas, so the pumps were down. So it was a few of us in there. And an individual was in there already when I walked in, And just through the peripheral of my eye, I could tell that this individual was really staring at me, really looking at me. Just so happens I had my uniform pants on. They're very distinctive, in the sense that 9 times out of 10, you could tell that that's a law enforcement officer. We typically don't wear the top in the street. A few minutes after waiting, another individual comes in really, really rowdy. And he says, yo, what the fuck is going on? Why is it taking so long? And excuse me for cursing. I could tell when the quiet guy kind of taps him and says, shh, yo, I think that guy is a cop. Okay. So now, this second guy, I could tell he's staring at me. And then I hear him say, yo, I think I know him. All this time, I'm still looking straight ahead as though I'm not paying attention to him. Mm-hmm. He turns around and says, yo, Brown. He called me by my last name. That's when I made eye contact with him. Now, the average individual, the average officer like me, I deal with hundreds and thousands of inmates over the course of my a year, over the course of my career. 9 times out of 10, they will recognize me before I recognize them. And he starts talking to me like, hey, man, how's Banks? And how's this? And how's that? And I'm like, yeah, they're all good. Everybody's good. His next words were, yo, Brown, you lucky you're not one of those dirty COs that jumped me and beat me up and blah, 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 blah. And I said to him, I said, well, if you know me, that's not my style. I said, you and I will go in the back and we will shoot that 5 and we will work it out. You're going to hold whatever you get. I'm going to hold whatever I get. It's all gravy. I then proceeded to raise up my shirt and say, well, if there's any other issues we got besides that, This right here is going to solve that if it's anything more than that. Nah, Brown, cool. Now, the reason why I'm telling you that story is because there's a problem that we have, mm-hmm, where we say they. Not every officer stood behind Chauvin and said that what he did was right. Not every officer defended what the officers did to Garner or any of those situations. There are a lot of officers that cringed the same way, just like all those videos that we started seeing from police officers that said, this is my taser, this is my gun. How could you confuse the two?
Right. But okay. to your point right there, Mr. Brown, to your point, that doesn't happen enough. And I think that was the point, 100%, right? Because honestly, that doesn't happen nearly enough. And a lot of times, the official stance, right? A lot of times the official stance is that there's an investigation, it was handled, and that's it, right? It's packaged up neat. So again, the lack of blue life accountability has created black life accountability, right? It's really created it. It's really saying, listen, we're saying we matter because you're saying we don't. Now, when we say about the generalizing, you're right about the generalizing, right? But that's the point of stereotypes. You're dealing with people as stereotypes instead of people, right? Every one of us is a person. You're right. There are criminals, and it's a very difficult job. But part of the job is, to your point, because remember, you just gave an example of how you were able to ascertain a potential threat prior to any real verbal communication. And some of that might have been your instincts. We believe some of that is your training. But that is what we're expecting with the badge. We're really expecting that, okay, you're clocking what's going on, right? So when those of us walking down the street doing nothing get treated the same way, those of us walking down the street doing something. And when you live in, quote-unquote, the hood, you know when you're doing something or nothing. You know where you go when you're doing something or nothing. I advocate for that all the time. When people say stop and frisk is messed up, I say, yeah, but I understand. Oh, what do you mean you understand? I understand that there are people who do the wrong thing. Now, I'm not saying stop and frisk is not abuse, but I'm also not going to say it serves no purpose, right? Now, maybe it's gone. Well, not maybe. It definitely went in a direction where it became abusive, right? But there's a reason why you know what corner to go get what. You understand? And I think your point of a war zone is something we have to really think about in America, because there's a reason why we don't use the military within our borders, because our military is very messy and very deadly. And when we say war zone, because like you said, we're literally saying that places where people of color live are war zones. And that opens up the entire area to be treated basically anyway. And we're seeing atrocities we're not necessarily accountability. And I understand what you're saying. It's very dangerous. But I think when we did the episode on the stereotypes, that's what I was trying to get across, that too many times we're not looking at the world for what it is. We're not looking at the Eric Garner situation for what really happened. We're looking at it through the stereotype. And the reality is there were people defending that officer strangled that man to death. And we saw it. And like, what defense is there? How do you not say, oh, well, that wasn't right? And we know that that wasn't right because look how long eventually it took before, whereas we saw what was happening. So I think that the word war zone, because that's something, if you listen to the last episode, Death by Traffic, that was something we're saying. Do we need to use police officers in every situation that we do use them? We know that we're trying to use mental health officers, if you will, to try to engage in non-threatening situations because not everyone is a threat in that way. And I think the recognition of that, not saying we have the answers, but recognizing that the answer is not always to send in, quote unquote, the military, right? We have to sometimes try diplomacy. We have to sometimes try foreign aid. I'm agreeing with you, the officers, when you send us in, we're going to go in, right? We're the soldiers. So if you send us into a war zone, we're ready to fight. But there's no war zone over there. And I think
I apologize. I agree. But I think what we're looking at across the entire country, we're looking at a small microcosm of situations, although they may be sensationalized, right? So now, to balance, if you can use the word balance, look at how many interactions in potentially dangerous situations that don't go awry by good police officers that use diplomacy and tact and everything. I saw it in the jails myself. I saw officers go to jail themselves because they went too far. It wasn't that the department said they went too far. We have a governing board of civilians that looks at particular uses of force and situations that will make decisions about officers, and that's where we come to the term excessive use of force. So we have situations in which officers, be it that they felt that they were defending themselves, did not sufficiently neutralize the threat until the threat was neutralized. Not saying death. I'm saying that the particular individual was hurt to the point where he was incapacitated, that were well within reason of doing it. Because when an inmate is coming at me with a shank or even with his bare fist, I cannot assume that they're coming at me to hurt me. I have to assume that they're coming at me to kill me. That is the perception once you step to that level of aggression. And it then goes back into the stereotype situation. How many of those situations did I talk down an individual? Did I use my interpersonal skills that I not only had going into the job, but was taught to use to de-escalate the situation? And how many times did it not work? Did it straight up not work that I had men bigger than me tell me they don't like me because of the uniform that I had on? I did not arrest them. I am not the police. I used to tell them that in the intake all the time. I'm not the police. I did not arrest you. I did not bring you here. You were brought to my house.
Exactly. And you make a really good point there, right? You're getting the aftermath of what someone else wearing a badge did, right? And like exactly. You said, you're at a place where they're already there, right? But the other parts of the badge are going into the communities, right? And that's why I said we don't use the military in every situation because we know what happens in the military, right? We understand that. So when you have a fire, you don't send in tanks when you have a fire. Why would we send in tanks? And we have to really question now, from a systemic point of view, with systemic racism, other things going on, are we sending tanks into non-combat situations, creating the climate? Same thing we do overseas, where the United States military does create terrorists, right? That's a different conversation. But because we live in a stereotype of we're the good guys and they're bad, so whatever we do is okay. And whatever they do is bad, right? We're never even having an honest conversation about why people are doing what they're doing. And that's part of the stereotypes. They're just bad. Yeah, but you just blew up his house, right? Is that so? If you blow up somebody, blows up your house, it's okay? He's wrong for being upset about his family being slaughtered? Oh, he's evil. Because you blew up his family, he's evil? Or you blew up his family? So I'm just saying, you know, as you said, we're trying to use this platform to have honest conversations. You're right. We do see some changes, like some changes of the needle moving. When you say it's a microcosm, I think the data might not fully agree with that, because I think that people of color are disproportionately being overly run by the system, and the level of accountability is not yet catching up. It's starting to catch up in the sensational cases. And like you said, we're seeing the sensational cases. But I think, Big Ruby, can speak to your point, blue line accountability means that it's catching up in most cases, right? Because we want most people held accountable for what they do, including officers, right? That's kind of the thing. And I think now that the camera's out there more, we're seeing it more. That's something Big Ruby always stresses. Not that it's happening more or less, we're just seeing it a lot more. But the thing is, when we see it, and when our reaction isn't the same as the blue lies reaction, like, that's okay. That's not okay. That's not reasonable. And I think that's what we're looking for, more accountability. So, Big Rube, sorry, I didn't mean to make your point, but definitely a good conversation.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I think this is a great conversation, great information that we're sharing. I love this perspective that Brother H is giving us, because I've never worked in law enforcement, so I have no perspective as far as how they perceive threats and how they handle certain situations. So I'm grateful for his input. So, you know, I'm just glad to get that that knowledge that I didn't have before.
Same here. Same here. Definitely. Thank you for sharing. Definitely.
My pleasure. I Rupert and I talk from time to time about different situations, and there's some that I'm like, man, that's crazy. And there's other times where I'm like, well, I don't know. And I will throw in one other thing. I'm like, in 12 years of working in corrections, I've had about maybe 3 inmates that said, yo, Brown, I really did it. I really did what it is they say I did.
Mm.
And I'm throwing that into the whole mix of things, because I think that in every situation, be it the sensationalized ones or the ones that are not, I think that you have officers that are on both sides of that spectrum. I think that the system in itself, once it goes to a legal situation, I think that gets very convoluted between the prosecution and the defense and what the facts are one way or the other. And I'm not saying every individual that's on Rikers Island deserves to be there or that they're a bad person. But I'm just saying that, you know, when you deal with tens of thousands of inmates over the course of your career, and, you know, and you develop rapports with many of them. And the ones that actually say I did it to you, but would never say it when they're in trial, you know, are very few and far in between. And it just speaks of, yes, it is a very generalized situation. I think that the ones, the blue lives that are not in tune with these complete atrocities and indiscretions, they're suppressed. They may be suppressed, be it through repercussions on their job, because I know what it is to cross the wrong captain, and then all of a sudden I'm working the worst house in the jail every day, and all of a sudden I'm working a double every day. I've seen it. I've lived it. And again, it's not right, but these are situations within the job and within the system that creates a lot of the monsters that we now see out on the streets. It's not enough. I used to be told all the time, you know, by inmates that, you know, correction officers are this and they're bums and they just the police and whatever. And I used to defend it like, yo, bro, like, we're not all like that. We're not all like that. And I have, when I worked in special trans, I have transported fellow former officers to facilities outside of Rikers Island, because they got into situations. Some were selling drugs. Mm. Some crossed the line and really hurt inmates because they jumped on them 4 or 5 and beat them down and, you know, all of these things. So I can speak from that perspective to say that a lot of times they great many times, because I've seen more officers get caught in corrections than not, where they paid the piper. They were held accountable. There was no captain saying, oh man, you should have beat the crap out of that inmate. I've never seen that. Never in my experience. So, I just feel like when I say microcosm, you know, we see those particular cases, but we compare those with the thousands of interactions that police officers have where a black man does not end up getting killed. You know, and we have to keep that in mind when we say they, because there's a lot of good officers, white and black, that are out there just trying to do their job and just get their 8 hours in or their double in and come on home and enjoy life.
Well said, well said. And I could say as a civilian, I root for those guys and girls, and I do. And it's very important that I know every time I see officers stand around randomly, I usually say good morning or hello, hi. And only because but I used to work security. And I know security, a lot of time you become invisible, right? You literally become part of the furniture. And when somebody says good morning, hello to you, it kind of reminds you that, oh yeah, I am a person, right? And I do exist. And I think that awareness is something I learned to realize. You know, officers stand in the corner, right? They're doing their job, but behind that, they're still a person. So good morning. Hey, how you doing? You know, everything good? Have a good one, right? Just to have the understanding. So I think that, thank you for sharing that, because you're right. You know, there are a lot of interactions that don't go the way. We are focusing on the ones that do go a certain way. I think the lack of accountability is a big one, because when you see something egregious and when you look at the data of the system, right? We just started out talking about systemic racism, both for those working in it and for all of us living in it. So we know that it's real. And I think we do feel like deer in the headlights. But you did give us some hope, saying that, you know what? A lot of times things do go the way they're supposed to. So we do try to end with a call to action. You've given us so many jewels. If you listen to the podcast, like I know you do, you know, we always do try to give our listeners a call to action, something they can implement, research, just to move the process forward. Because we're not trying to talk to talk. We're trying to talk to change. So any call to action, anything you just want to put out there just to make the world a little bit better place based on enforcing the law?
Just from the perspective of being a former law enforcement officer, we're not all the same. We're not. And, you know, that whole perspective of treating individuals as individuals and not to prejudge, not to stereotype. You know, there's a lot of individuals that they just took the time, 2 seconds, to have a conversation. You know, say good morning, say hello. It makes all the difference in the world. And I'll leave it like that. We got to treat human beings as human beings.
Well said, brother. Well said. Well said. That is definitely call to action. Big Rube, you have any call to action? Anything to put out to the listeners enforcing the law?
I mean, it was well said by Brother Brown. I would say basically from my end, see something, say something. And to your point, the officer's there. You can say good morning, good afternoon. Have a good mode of communication with them. Have them feel as though they're part of the community, not just an outsider. You don't have to be their best friend, but you can treat them with some respect. If they're getting more respect in the community, maybe they're going to be able to treat us with more respect.
Well said. Well said. I think my call to action will be just to piggyback on both of you guys and to say again, the word that's been just jumping out a lot is accountability. I think all of us as people just want fairness to be fair, right? Whatever is. So I think if we hold ourselves accountable and work to hold each other accountable, right? Not black lives, not blue lives, but just everyone, right? Whatever we do, we should be judged by our actions and treat each other the way we want to be treated. So I think that's where I'll leave it. So Big Brother H, thank you so much for taking this very special day, making it that much more special, right? Because thank you for committing to the podcast, because we definitely needed your insight. This is the topic of the day in our society, and it really is. And thank you for taking this very special day to share with us, because it's a very special day to you, which makes it special to us. Happy birthday again.
Thank you very much, and it is my complete pleasure.
Yes, enjoy the birthday. Don't get into too much trouble.
It's all relative on what that is exactly, but hey.
Joy, it's a pleasure having you. Thanks for all the insight.
My pleasure.
And for our listeners, today's episode was enforcing the law. We'll definitely continue the conversation because we're all part of that conversation. And take some of the call to actions to heart, whatever we can do. You know, say hi to an officer, right? The same way a lot of officers will say hello, good morning to you. And let's realize that we are all people and we're all in this world together. And let's just do our part. Let's everybody do our part to just treat each other the way we want to be treated. So I'll just say, again, enforcing the law, I'm Sean P.
I'm Big Root.
And we are the brothers.
Peace out.
I'm tired of the same rap songs. Every new hit, sing along. Rap is so boring, now correct me if I'm wrong. It's like they took the art out the art form. What's going on, man? I don't understand it. I want something good to listen to, I demand it. All the real artists on another planet. And me, I'm the last MC still standing.